Well, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to this plenary session. I might just make a few opening comments and introductions as we fill up the room here and set the scene for a really interesting session of a type that I've never had any experience of before. It's kind of a Jeffrey Robertson hypotheticals kind of thing, but this time with evaluation. And the panel we have assembled for you will have some very interesting perspectives to contribute. We had originally thought of having each person speak for about 8 minutes on two scenarios out of the three that you have on the document on your seat. And I'll invite you just to have a look at that document, because it sort of sets the known facts about the three scenarios. The panel has proved recalcitrant and something of a self-governing collective, and rather than speak 8 minutes at a time on a couple of scenarios, we've agreed it might be best to open up with Andrew Lee, who perhaps is the one member of the panel you haven't met at sessions over the last day or two. So just a few words of introduction for Andrew. Professor of Economics at the ANU, something of a specialist in labour economics, public economics, and the economics of elections, but very interested in the potential of randomised controlled trials in social and economic policy areas, and you may have seen him write a bit on that, including in quite accessible ways in our Australian Financial Review. I think introductions for the rest of the panel are less necessary in a way, because you've encountered them all in previous sessions. But very briefly, Dr. Philip Davies of Oxford Evidentia, and all sorts of interesting background in the Cabinet Office in the UK, and lecturing at Oxford University. Next to Philip, Professor William Trocham, who almost all of you will remember from that excellent opening discussion yesterday morning. And furthest from me, Professor Patricia Rogers, Professor of Public Sector Evaluation at RMIT University. Andrew and Patricia were very valuable contributors to the Productivity Commission roundtable that I mentioned to you in my own comments yesterday morning. So great to have us all here again together. I think the way the panel would like to try this is for Andrew just to make a few minutes of opening comments, and then to move to the scenarios in numerical sequence, with each of the speakers picking up the scenario they wanted to comment on, and trying to do that in a way that gets as much of a dialogue as possible among the panel, and preserves 10 or 15 minutes at the end for general discussion with the audience. So with those few introductory comments, let me just turn over to Andrew, and we'll all try to live to about a 5 minute sort of introduction or 5 minute comment and get the discussion going as nicely as we can. So over to you, Andrew.
Thanks, Terry. There's an old line that when the actor sits down, the play sits down. So I sort of always feel compelled to present standing up. But I apologise for if I'm looking like I'm leaping to the stage. Also, apologies for not having been here for the duration of the conference. My co-author Joshua Gans and I released a study on media bias yesterday, and have spent our last couple of days fielding calls from people asking why we didn't discover that the ABC was biased towards the left. My particular philosophy when it comes to evaluation is perhaps somewhat different from many of those in the room. As an economist, I essentially think of evaluation in terms of the exercise of discovering the counterfactual. The counterfactual is a tricky little beast, being the world that we would have had, and naturally gets you into discussions of parallel universes over a couple of glasses of wine. But in the context of evaluation, means that you need to think very rigorously, as I'm sure you all know, about how to imagine what would have happened had the intervention not been put into place. And in the context of social policy, many of us working on natural experiments in the economics literature frequently start off discussing our natural experiments by saying, well, naturally the benchmark here would have been a randomised trial that would have ensured that the two groups were perfectly comparable on observable and unobservable characteristics. Because we don't have a randomised trial, we're going to try and use these natural experiments. And, you know, I've spent much of my career trying to work out different clever contexts in which one can use natural experiments. But I think the use of natural experiments is, in most social policy evaluations, a second best. I think the notion that evaluation should be tailored to the problem at hand is an eminently sensible one, but I think it's important not to let that notion sort of let us slide into a swamp of relativism in which all evaluation methodologies are always equally as good as one another. I think for most social policy interventions one can think of, a randomised evaluation is perhaps not the only form of evaluation you'd want, but you would definitely want it as part of the outcome measures. The criticisms of randomised trials from a methodological viewpoint centre around notions of generalisability and scale effects. If you're worried that your intervention is going to have an impact on non-participants, you might well want to be concerned, for example, in a labour market program, that those who are receiving training are not simply taking the jobs of those who didn't receive training. But I don't think that suggests we want to throw away a randomised experiment. It suggests we would like some randomised evidence and some non-randomised evidence. And all too frequently, what randomised evidence tells us when we're looking at labour market programs is that the program had no effect on participants. Active labour market programs are one of those areas where the more rigorous your evaluation, typically the smaller your policy effects. So I think the notion of a hierarchy is a useful rule of thumb. We want to think of an evidence hierarchy in much the same way as we think of returns to education. So it is not always true that those with more years of education earn more in the labour market, but as a rule of thumb, it's not a bad way of thinking of how the labour market works. Likewise, in evaluation, it's not always the case that a randomised trial is going to be the best form of evaluation, but as a general rule of thumb, a randomised evaluation is going to give you a more credible counterfactual than a natural experiment, which in turn will give you typically a more credible counterfactual than a straightforward before or after study. It also frequently gets you a different answer. Two examples of policies which we used to like based on natural experiments, but we came to be much more sceptical about when we had randomised evaluations, are Scared Straight and Neighbourhood Watch. Scared Straight is a terrific program that actually came out of an Academy Award winning movie in 1978. In the movie, a bunch of kids who'd sort of gotten into some trouble were taken along and shown the inside of a jail and shown what life behind bars was really like. And they were scared straight. They went on to the good path that took them into high-paying jobs. And so many US state legislators thought, well, this is a terrific program, let's put this sort of program in place for delinquent youth. And before or after comparisons, or comparisons based on those who selected in and those who didn't, seemed to suggest that Scared Straight worked. Some of them suggested that Scared Straight cut crime by up to 50%. Eventually, by the late 1980s, some legislators decided to put it to the test using randomised evaluation. Toss a coin, heads you go into Scared Straight, tails you don't. Turned out then going to Scared Straight, if anything, increased crime. The intuition for this is that these kids had their own notion as to what life behind bars was like, and actually when they got to see life behind bars, it wasn't as bad as they'd thought. So we need to recognise that sometimes when you raise the evidence bar, you actually get quite a different answer. Same is true of Neighbourhood Watch. Communities with Neighbourhood Watch tend to be safer communities. But that's not a causal effect of Neighbourhood Watch. It tells you something about the kinds of communities that want Neighbourhood Watch. If you do sort of randomised evaluation and you randomly have the police set up Neighbourhood Watch groups in different communities, you find the establishment of Neighbourhood Watch has no impact on crime rates in different communities. Very popular program, voters love it, does nothing to cut crime. So I think it is important to recognise that raising the evidence bar can give us different different results in many cases, and I would argue if we want a credible counterfactual, randomization frequently can give us that.
Thanks very much, Andrew. Thank you. And let's keep the conversation rolling. I guess in numerical sequence of the scenarios, based perhaps on tossing a coin or something or other, Philip Davies and Patricia Rogers had both opted among their choices to talk about the hypothetical of an evaluation of the online privacy guide for young people dealing with privacy issues, a 5-month study with an $80,000 budget, which they're very interesting facts to know about how to get your head around this particular evaluation problem. Over to our other panellists. Patricia, would you like to speak first?
Sure. Last minute negotiation here. Thank you for these scenarios. They do represent a range of real evaluation issues and challenges. And I think one of the first things that really struck me about this first scenario, which you should all have on seats, is that it's talking about a quite different type of evidence. When I first looked at it and I started thinking about how to do an effectiveness evaluation, and then I went back and read it a bit more carefully, and it's actually a needs assessment. And I think this is a great scenario to remind us that we need different types of evidence to answer different types of questions in evaluation. I did a similar exercise to this earlier this year where we were given some scenarios, but we didn't have a budget. Julie Elliott from Finance has put a budget on it, which did mean that you couldn't just come up with these wild flights of fancy. So I started literally doing a little budget on this of how much time that would translate to for this online privacy guide, and started looking at the sorts of evidence you would want to bring to bear and who would be able to do that. I mean, if we look, the key evaluation question is, what is the nature of the privacy problems that young people are experiencing? So we're wanting to not enumerate them, we're trying to get the dimensions, what sort of things are there, we're trying to make sense of this, but the reason is to inform decisions about the merits of this type of program. So we want something there about the significance of them. Are they trivial privacy problems, or are they really a matter of concern? Is there a large stakeholder concern about these, or are they something that's only of concern to, you know, a few people? So we would look at some existing research and some expert advice, looking at newspaper articles. I think you would actually end up spending a lot of time lurking in chat rooms and internet and so on that. And what a surprise, you'd probably have to talk to young people. And then I suddenly started thinking, I'm not the person to do that. You need someone much younger and groovier. So we're suddenly changing the way we're doing this, and maybe they'd be online, you know, talking to people and so on. So one of the issues here is about looking at the sort of skills of how you go about collecting this information. Then I went back to the budgets, and now I've got this team of young groovy things working with us. And one of the questions is about, where does the money go and who gets the money? A lot of this is going to be about talking with young people. And sometimes you can have this situation where you're trying to get information from people. You have a bunch of people sitting in a room and all the researchers are being paid and the people providing the information aren't. And I know this comes up a lot in community groups. So I started divvying up the budget to actually be paying some people perhaps to be involved in that. The other option that we might look at, so that's just doing a big sweep of different ideas and trying to make sense of it. The other thing you could do is actually allocate some of this money to start looking at market segmentation, because just coming back to the government and saying, well, there's all these sorts of issues and here's some examples would be one thing, but it would be actually much better, I think, if you had market segmentation where you could talk about types of young people, types of interactions with the internet and types of privacy. And so you might actually really engage with market researchers and do some much more sophisticated stuff. Thank you.
Over to
just
you.
Stayed on. Yeah.
Okay. Thanks.
Well, thank you very much. First of all, as a prefatory comment, it's very interesting to spend a few days now even discussing the hierarchies issue. I honestly and truly thought we put that one to bed 10 years ago. So it's clearly a burning issue, and I want to revisit it in a way I think we did 10 years ago. So the first thing I'd say is on the scenario is the question, the key question we've been asked to address is, to me, is not really an evaluation question, but it's the sort of question you absolutely need to ask on the way to a full-blown evaluation. A bit like, as Bill said yesterday, in medical clinical trials, you do a phase one, a phase two, and a phase three. This is sort of a phase one question for me, which is a very important one, which is, as you say, it's a needs assessment, or what is the nature of the problem question. For that, quite clearly, the random allocation trial or any of the quasi-experimental trials would be simply inappropriate because they don't address that question at all. You're right, we'd be using a combination of survey data, if there are any available, or commissioning them, in-depth interviewing, focus groups, maybe other consultative techniques such as the Delphi method or the nominal group techniques. Or possibly, what I would do is start with a research synthesis, because it may well be that somebody's already been working on this issue elsewhere, and there's an awful lot of information we could glean, or no information that we could glean from that. So to me, that would be building up to another question, which would be really about something along the lines of, is the online resource for young people an effective and an efficient way of dealing with this issue? And that's when you might get into the territory that Andrew was covering. You obviously there are looking for some sort of control or some sort of comparison group. And as good as the randomized controlled trial is, and I agree with Andrew, I certainly agree with him about Scared Straight, which if I have a chance, I'll come back to. But I wouldn't even think of a randomized controlled trial for quite simple reasons. We've only got $80,000. With that, you're not going to get the size of the samples you'd really want, I don't think. Particularly if you're going to do a two-arm or a three-arm trial, you're going to land up with such small cells, you're just not going to have the power, you're just not going to get the minimal detectable effect. So I probably, if I most certainly, would not use a random allocation trial for that. Might look for some other sort of comparator, something like a matched comparison trial with or without a propensity score matching, maybe a difference of differences, maybe a regression discontinuity scale. I'd look for something else, which I think goes to the point that the vertical pyramidal downward hierarchical model really isn't really helping us. It's, if anything, we're talking about a circular sequential model where we move around a series of alternatives until we can find a method and a design that best suits the circumstance and the question being asked. So that's all I say at the moment on scenario one.
I just have one quick comment. If we're allowed to look at effectiveness on this, one of the points I think that's worth making is that we would expect this to operate like viral marketing. If we had an online resource, yeah, we would actually hope that the young people would pass on that information. And so comparing users of the online guide and non-users is likely to really not give us the true effect of it, because you'd get lots of second, third, fourth hand uses of it if it was working well. Would you make a comment?
No, I'm fine.
Just a closing question that you might be able to come back to later. It bears a bit, I suppose, on Patricia's point about the sort of viral contamination of people who haven't been directly exposed to the program but might have indirectly picked up some influence from it. When you've only got a small budget but it is essentially an online issue, is there some way you can design an online way of approaching people who haven't been directly aware of this program or have been, and keep your costs down in that way?
See, the issue, it's the effects of this program if this was really radically successful, it would change the norms, people and knowledge, and people wouldn't know about it. They'd just say, oh, that, you know, don't do it like that, put your password in like that. And they wouldn't say, I learnt that on that online guide. Mm. Right? And they're just not going to. So even asking them, where did you hear about it, they'd just say, oh, it was my friend.
Uh-huh.
So I think the issue about looking for who hasn't used the guide isn't going to be helpful in this case.
Great. Okay, thanks.
Actually, let me jump in and segue onto scenario two, which is where I think you were going to go. But I think I can also tie in a welcome to Andrew, and tie in some comments about scenario one, because I'm also interested in that idea. Andrew, I feel like I've known you since graduate school because you're coming from a perspective that I very much grew up in and very much appreciate. But it was interesting to me that you jumped right into this talking about evaluation by talking about a counterfactual. And my first reaction to that was, is that really what he thinks evaluation is? And then my second reaction was, well, how about the factual? We're talking about the counterfactual. Counterfactual to what? What is the factual? So I started thinking about the factual would have to be the treatment or program we're interested in looking at. Before we start looking at counterfactuals, I got to make sure we really have a treatment or program that we're countering with some comparison, right? So before I'm going to mount some randomized experiment with a counterfactual, I want to look at the construct of the program, the construct of the cause, in a sense, the factual. That's rigorous, too. That's something that has to happen before you can get counterfactual. So what does that mean? Now I'm in the realm of construct validity, and this is a great example. Scenario one, I looked online, is a really nice, colorful brochure. It's a PDF file. And so this online privacy guide for young people, as it stands right now, is that. And I think that's great in and of itself, but is that what we mean by online? You take a PDF file, a very colorful one, you put it online, is that the factual to which we want to look at a counter? You could imagine any number of variations of that. So now we're in the game of asking ourselves, what's the theory of the program that we're dealing with here? And these are the hearts of evaluation questions that at least I deal with when I get to this. And all of this stuff has to happen before I get to the issue of the counterfactual, because if it isn't, I'm not going to do a good, rigorous job on the counterfactual. I've got to do a good, rigorous job on the factual and on how I'm going to observe that. Now, it turns out that scenario number two is the same basic scenario to me. You folks probably know me enough to know that you throw any problem at me, my first question is going to be really one of construct validity. What the heck are we talking about? What is the program? What are the outcomes? What do we mean by that? I mean, I spent 25 years of my career trying to work on concept mapping methods to help people to surface these kinds of things. Well, so stormwater harvesting and reuse, there again, I would start with some fundamental questions. What is stormwater harvesting and reuse, and how are they defining it in this context? And what are the outcome constructs that they're trying to get at. You start with those two things, and who wants to know? Who are the stakeholders who have an interest in this, and do they all have the same perspectives? So I start off in evaluating these kinds of things. I'd be interested right off the bat, long before I get to an experimental design, which I may very well want to do at some point down the road. I would want to be asking questions about what's the program, what is the outcome or outcomes, how would we know if we're doing a good job, a consistent job of implementing the program we're saying we're implementing? Are we implementing it consistently? Can multiple parties implement it? Is it the one people want to implement? What are the outcomes we're trying to get at? Can we measure them? Can we do that measurements of them with high quality and rigor? Can we do it consistently and so on? So in almost all these scenarios, I keep coming back to those same kinds of things. And I guess I'll just end by saying that I do worry, Andrew, about setting up language that positions us in ways that might not be productive. So, for instance, I heard you talk a lot about rigor. And I'm as interested in rigor as anybody is interested in rigor, and yet I come to a very different position in terms of the role of randomized experimental designs. It's not a question of rigor versus your other wonderful phraseology, which was the swamp of relativism, and I sure as heck don't want to be the swamp of relativism in that. So I think we do want to be concerned about rigor, and what I'm going to keep coming back to in the comments that I have has to do with how can we be rigorous about not just figuring out what method to use appropriately, because that's a rigorous question, but also how can we be rigorous in making sure that we're doing these things in the right time, in the right sequence. So you might call that relativistic, maybe it is, and maybe we need a rigor of those kinds of criteria so that we are not applying the wrong tool for the wrong part of the problem.
Thanks very much. Now, Patricia, I think you'd also expressed an interest in this topic. Is
sure.
there anything
Andrew,
you...
Did you want to make any comments, Andrew? Did you want to comment on that?
Before
So it is sort of interesting. Maybe we're at odds somewhat in the question of what is evaluation. As an economist, I basically think that evaluation starts at the point at which you have a designed program. The impression I get is you have a notion of evaluation, which is that evaluation is part of the design of a program itself. So that might explain part of where we're at odds here. I don't regard this first one, in some sense, as an evaluation.
No, but even if you started there, if you were going to do a rigorous evaluation, you would have to verify that that program is designed, that it is carried out consistently, that you can understand and deal with the variability. You can make some judgments about what variability is noise and what variability is program related. All that would have to be part of even your definition of evaluation. Right. You can't just assume a designed program that works perfectly, assume a set of outcomes you can already measure perfectly, and then say, so now there's our starting point, and now what we'll do is we'll say evaluation is the task of then constructing a counterfactual. I mean, I think that wouldn't, to me, be rigorous evaluation, even within that framework. I mean, I don't know how you'd think that.
Mm-hmm. Whereas, you know, I've obviously been brainwashed by John Owen's forms of evaluation that says needs assessment is actually evaluation. And I do absolutely see it as something that is throughout the cycle and throughout the sort of stages of proud programs, but is also part of ongoing adaptable programs, so that, you know, the simple, complicated, complex ones. Mm-hmm. So we're going to go to scenario two. Stormwater harvesting. I'd say, okay, I'm putting the team together. I think, okay, we need a civil engineer here. I was very taken by a recent report where they were looking at buying back the water rights for a big farm, a big station, so that water could be released into the river and save the river. And someone pointed out that what would happen is that the farms downstream who've had the water rights but haven't been able to use them because there hasn't been enough water in the river would just suck it up as it went past, and you're not actually saving the river. So I think this one's got some real challenges about counterfactual, and it makes me very aware that there's not a single counterfactual. What would have happened? Well, it's hard to know. What would have happened if you'd married your first boyfriend? You know, sorry, girlfriend, if you like.
I don't want to touch that.
She can answer that.
So this one, I think, has some real challenges in it. I also thought what's interesting here is we have a national program that's putting the money out, and then they do stuff, and we're trying to both learn, well, what's been the effect of it, but how do we build evidence as a sound basis? And so what I was thinking about is, again, our notion that sometimes we focus in evaluation on a discrete evaluation. You send in this external evaluator with a clipboard or something, and then they go away and they come back with a report. And what I was seeing here is actually linking it much more to performance monitoring. These, ideally, ideal world, you would want these projects to be reporting in a way that is actually building the evidence base. So if you had some money here in this budget, one way you make it your $150,000 go further is you get them to do all the data collection. You have some roles there where you might work around the reporting requirements, so it's something that's going to be useful for them and something that you could then use centrally. You might include some data audit there. Did they actually put in these new systems? Have they actually change the way that they water the cricket pitch? That's a game here, right?
It is. I was imagining insects. And
you might do some additional data collection, and you might do a lot of analysis and reporting. So thinking about this evaluation at the centre, that's not just sucking up the data from all these projects, but also helping them to do that in a way that's building the evidence base. The other thing that stood out for me was about the evaluative criteria here. We're looking at effectiveness and efficiency. So effectiveness, Jerry Winston gave the discussion about, is it just they met their objectives, or is it looking at the overall outcomes? And efficiency, not just technical, how quickly did they get the money out the door, which is sometimes how it's defined in government, but actually what were the savings and what was the total cost of it? And pulling
benefits.
in, yeah, all the costs and all the benefits. This is something where they partly subsidise them and the community has to put in at least 50%. So you've got to make sure you count all the costs and all the benefits in that. But what's missing there is anything about equity. Doing some more research on this in the Australian, the school stimulus plan fails the test for the neediest. So the Australian has gone and done an analysis of where the money's going in the stimulus package in which schools have got knocked back. And as a member of the AES, I'm bound by the ethics guidelines, which I always append to my contracts. And one of them is that we have to consider the impact of this on the most disadvantaged in the community. So that would actually start to say, where did the money go? Which electorates and so on? Might be some of the uncomfortable questions you might like to ask.
That's good. Thank you. I think we're pretty much on schedule. Would you like to discuss a little bit further on this scenario?
Just real quick on scenario two. One of the things that struck me about that is it reminds me of the fact that a lot of evaluation issues stem from the idea that we're dealing with systems problems. And here, it's hard for me to know whether the program here is the funding mechanism funding a whole slew of things that could be very, very different in lots of different places. It's the 50-50 matching funding that the Australian government is doing, or is it the stuff that then is being funded? So you've got lots of local projects, and you've got a funding mechanism. And we have this problem all the time in the States. And actually, there are evaluation issues at both levels. You do want to know whether this particular mechanism for dealing with urban stormwater actually works well in this particular context and so on. But you also are going to want to know, in the aggregate, was it worth the investment? Did this work well? Was it an effective way to use public funds to spend this 50-50 match on this whole thing? So I was, and to me, a lot of this winds up falling in the category of boundary conditions for a program. That, to me, is a systems ecology issue, another sort of branch of science that is relevant to evaluation thinking. How do we set the boundaries on these kinds of very sometimes difficult to bound issues? And so that was the other comment I just wanted to make about that.
Thank you.
Okay. Well, let's pitch to Philip and move over to a discussion of the third of those scenarios, the deinstitutionalization of people with mental illness. One of the interesting things that caught my eye about this evaluation into a pretty broad-ranging issue is that, unlike the previous two, it has a significant time and budget associated with it. And my ears pricked up because 12 months and $1 million is about what a Productivity Commission public inquiry costs you. So that's an option you might like to comment on too. over to you.
We'll just outsource it.
Well, this is a very interesting one because, of course, the deinstitutionalization of mental illness has been around, again, for an awful long time. Ben and I were saying earlier, this is a perennial. And we seem to keep, in all countries I go to, seem to keep making the same mistakes. Certainly Britain had a very similar program to the one that's being described here, so I'm familiar with it. The question we're being asked here, again, we're being asked really two or three questions. The first one is important because it asks, as an evaluation question, you know, what is the question, what is the problem? And I think that's good because it makes us clarify what it is we need to know and how we go to find out about it. It seems to be, from the scenario as it's set, there is the common received wisdom that this has only had negative results. I think that's probably true. But it does mean that one of the things we need to do in evaluation is to not accept that prima facie, and we have to actually go and find some evidence for it and go and find some evaluative evidence to do that. So for that element of the question, I, because I work a lot in health sciences, I would work with my epidemiological colleagues who are frankly much better skilled than I am at doing time series analysis, particularly retrospective time series analysis, which I tend to run away from as fast as I can. I don't like doing retrospective studies, but there are those people who are very talented at doing it. And it's bread and butter stuff for many of the epidemiologists, because that's what they have to do. Because in the real world, they're asked to go back, we've had a disease, but you know, what caused it, what was the flow of it, what was the stock, and so forth. So I would imagine we would be looking at some sort of time series analysis, maybe an interrupted time series study, I'm not sure. The sort of data we would need would be health services data, general population or general household data. I'd have thought, health service, health usage data, police data. You would really be very much like a detective putting together lots of bits of information to try and find out what is the nature of the problem, or was the nature of the problem, what is the size of it, and what was driving it. And I think that is that would take a lot of the it's a million, isn't it? So it, you know, that'd get us going. But then there's a second question, there's a third question, because then we have the what worked and for whom. Let me come on to the, we then move into a what works question. I like the bit was what has been learned to guide future practice. My experience is probably nothing's been learned at all, which is precisely why we keep making the same mistakes every 20 years. But if we put that into saying how might we learn where we keep going wrong, then I would look very much, because of my professional bias, I would start not experimental or necessarily quasi-experimental design. I would start with what is actually the new gold standard, if you look at the Cochrane list, it's the systematic review. In fact, I was thinking of this yesterday in one of the presentations. I think RCTs were relegated to silver status about 10 or 15 years ago. It's the statistical meta-analysis that actually comes up on most people's, if you're having a hierarchy. So I would naturally, my proclivity would go say, well, what do we know about what are effective interventions? What has been tried elsewhere? What has been shown to work and what hasn't? Now, this morning, it took me 43 minutes to find 16 systematic reviews and 9 guidelines on that issue. And that's worldwide. One was from Australia, up the road in Sydney, and one was in New Zealand, in a town that I'm not going to pronounce right, Rotorua.
Very good.
Right, okay. I've no idea where it is, but they've done it with some people in London, England. So. But that's interesting that there is a body of evidence out there that not only is of general interest, but probably has interest to this neck of the woods. What was interesting about that was the very mixed nature of the evidence that they'd reviewed. Some of them in the Cochrane collaboration were randomized controlled trials. The conclusion from all of them was that none of these randomized controlled trials detected any effect, and or were not good enough to really, or had been done well enough, or large enough, or been reported adequately enough to really tell us anything, which is actually very depressing. And just as an aside, for those of us who do lots of reviews, that is a very common finding. That the RCT, it's not whether you do RCTs or not, it's just that they're usually done so badly, as indeed are quasi-experimental designs, we don't put them into the corpus of material that we review, because they're either done badly or they're badly reported. But most of the data, I just did a quick checklist. There were a couple of quasi-experimental studies that were in the review. There was case control studies, cohort studies, case management studies, qualitative studies, one of which was a very interesting study on the use of herbal medicines on people with psychosis. This really did surprise me. And quite a lot of economic analysis as well. So again, I can't handle a vertical pyramidal model in that. I just see this like smorgasbord of interesting things that we are drawing upon. And the reason why I say that is the Cochrane and the DARE. The DARE is the database of abstract of the reviews of effectiveness. It comes out of the University of York, the Centre for Reviews of Dissemination. They have a very high bar indeed, a very high bar of what counts as quality. And they've had to broaden what goes into the corpus of material that we review. And even so, in order to do that, then we get a lot of interesting information that will contribute to our understanding of that issue. And If anybody's interested, I can give you the, I've taken the references of the 23 studies that are already out there, and that was in 43 minutes this morning until the my money ran out.
Well, think what you could do with $1 million.
With $1 million, I mean, I could be an anorak and a nerd forever.
You could.
Yeah, I'll pass on now.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks very much. Over to you, William.
I wanted to come back to the hierarchy question. You know, I there is value in hierarchies. There is value in rules of thumb. But it does seem to me in this area that it would be useful for us to start thinking about not a hierarchy of evidence, but different hierarchies of evidence that are linked to the inferences that we're trying to make. So if you're trying to make an inference about descriptive kinds of matters, there might be a certain hierarchy of evidence or descriptive kinds of matters under certain kinds of conditions. We might have a slew of hierarchies. Certainly for relational kinds of efficacy questions, there might be a certain hierarchy. The Institute of Medicine in the U.S., and as I mentioned in my talk yesterday, is really, I think, sensitive to the fact that certain methods have real advantages. They're at the top of the hierarchy for addressing certain kinds of questions. So we might need to broaden our notion of hierarchies. Now, the deinstitutionalization thing really took me back to research that I had been involved with early on in my career, because I was very involved in mental health. And the first reaction I had is the reaction I have to just about everything. It's the hammer and nail thing. What the heck do we mean by deinstitutionalization? I took 30 seconds on the internet today and looked for definitions of deinstitutionalization, and it doesn't take any time to figure out that even in the field there's tremendous disparity of opinions about what is that, what constitutes deinstitutionalization. So I did work in the mid-80s on an aspect of deinstitutionalization that was one way of trying to approach deinstitutionalization called supported employment. And supported employment, actually, in the way they operationalized this program, involved having a mobile job support worker, taking people who were deinstitutionalized and who otherwise would have been in a sheltered workshop context, and having a mobile job support worker who'd be available to them. You'd put these folks out in jobs, and then they'd actually have somebody who could work alongside them, or who could be on call if they began to decompensate or hallucinate or whatever. And the idea was to get people on the job and keep them there, however you have to do it. This is supported employment, and this was in contrast to traditional sheltered workshops. You put them in a job where there's a whole bunch of them doing something relatively trivial and so on. And we were doing I was doing regression discontinuity designs back then, and I think we did some regression discontinuity designs. We had outcome variables that were pretty standard, multi-item scales that were scales of depression, anxiety, and all that stuff. So what happened? Just to cut to the chase, we did these regression discontinuity designs, sheltered workshops versus supported employment. 100 different outcome items, regression discontinuity design, we estimated treatment effects, we got all these whopping statistically significant treatment effects. And I had somehow along the line thought, you know, maybe it'd be a good idea to find out what the staff of this program thought would happen. And so I at one point asked them to for each one of the 100 items on these multiple scales, I set up a little line, you know, here's the high and the low. I said, here's where these folks were measured on the pretest. Where do you think with the support employment program they would be on the post? It's sort of a Bayesian Bayesian process. And so they say, well, we think they're going to be here. So we then matched the staff's expectations of effects against the observed regression discontinuity treatment effect estimates, the beta values or whatever, and we found a whoppingly huge correlation between those two. Unfortunately, it was negative. And what had happened was that the staff said, we put these people in jobs and keep them there, they'll be less anxious, less symptomatic, less depressed, you just go right down the line. What happened? They put people into really crummy jobs.
Yes.
And these people, most people in really crummy jobs got more anxious, more depressed, more symptomatic. So I don't know what the moral of that story is.
It don't work.
but
But it's about quality of implementation.
It is about quality of implementation and what it means and what is the relationship of theory and what you think you're doing to what you're doing and how does that interplay with these kinds of causal assessments, which we do need to do. There is a literature, not on deinstitutionalization as a construct because it's too big and messy, but I think there is a good literature on different sub-aspects of that. Some of that experimentally or quasi-experimentally based, and the first place I'd go is to those meta-analyses and systematic reviews of that literature, because I think that we already do know something about that. Some of that stuff does work. A lot of what failed in deinstitutionalization didn't have to do with those kinds of treatments. It had to do with the political will and the political context within which we did that, and I think that that's a different story.
Can I just add to that? There is a very... Go ahead. One caveat is even if you find in these statistical meta-analyses and reviews and guidelines strong evidence, then you have another evaluation question is, will it work in Australia or will it work in a particular part of Australia? If we've learnt at our peril, it's what we tend to do in the UK is often find an interesting program in the US, mm-hmm. pick it up and drop it into the UK, and then we find it doesn't work. It doesn't surprise me at all, mm-hmm. given the different healthcare systems of the United States and the welfare systems, different populations, you know, every variable we can imagine is different. Mm-hmm. So you're encouraged by the fact that you've got a potentially workable program, but you must, when you take the evidence from even the most sophisticated and very large sampled meta-analysis, you must do an implementation evaluation before you roll it out. Otherwise, you're seriously going to make mistakes, mm-hmm. and I've seen that time and time mm-hmm. again.
Mm-hmm. Can I just add one quick comment? What I would really like to see in this would be to use a method that does, in its evidence, draw on studies that really look at differential effects among different types of participants.
Absolutely.
That really takes into account the implementation, the quality of the implementation. And I would really like to see a realist synthesis of this. It allows you to draw on a much greater variety of data. It is not about a swamp of relativism. It's not about everything goes in. It's about looking that the data is of sufficient quality to support the conclusions that are drawn. And then you actually sort that by the context, the mechanisms and the different outcomes, because you are likely to find quite different outcomes for their access to services, the quality of services, the types of mental illness and so on. And when you have that data, then you would go through juxtaposing, reconciling, adjudicating, consolidating and situating it to actually have some coherent patterns about that.
That's crucial, because as Bill was saying about trying to deconstruct the whole deinstitutionalization question, you have to do exactly the same with the term mental illness. In the work I was looking at today, mental illness went from psychosis, schizophrenia, depression, to shoplifting, homelessness and anorexia. Well, they're very different types of problems that people have in life. So your point about subgroup analysis is crucial, and you really do have to start asking some very intelligent and challenging questions, again, up front, before you start getting into the more sexy stuff of using... can I say that? Oh, you said it yesterday,
yeah,
so it's all right.
Of
doing RCTs or some other Fandango system of quasi experiment.
That's great. Thank you very much. And we can obviously rattle on a lot here and very productively too.
We haven't started.
But,
don't get us started.
We're bounded at the outer end by the annual general meeting, and we should really provide some opportunities for a few questions or comments from the floor. If anyone would like to pose a question or comment, I think I can see two microphones in the corridors there you might like to move to. As you do so, Andrew, anything you'd like to comment on from what you've heard across the three scenarios?
So I should confess there is a reason why I kicked off, which is that all of these three scenarios, while being very interesting, lack one important character. That is that none of them are prospective analyses of social or education policies, which are actually the very context in which you might think about doing some sort of randomised style evaluation. So virtually everything that Jenny Macklin or Julia Gillard thinks about rolling out could well be evaluated in a randomised sense. It's pretty clear to me that you wouldn't try it with these three particular scenarios.
Thanks. I think we have someone at the microphone there. Please.
Hi, Matthew Nograti. I work in Faxia. In Professor Trockham's opening address, you drew attention to a document that insinuated into the Office of Management and Budgeting this sort of subtly conflated rigour or lack of rigour with something being essentially meaningless. And I think it's interesting how it seems to me people who are keen on hierarchies are also quite ready to let them lapse into basically one good thing and everything else being rubbish, sort of the gold standard and everything else. And the phrase the swamp of relativism also pricked my ears up in that. This seems like a kind of arthritic old bogeyman from 20 years ago to be pulling out that sort of straw man of
Yeah, that stuff sort of pushes my buttons and then I start saying unreasonable things back, which is not a good strategy. But
I'm gonna thick skin.
Good, I knew you did, Andrew. I could tell.
I think
that was the U.S. Department of Education, but you OMB would be the same thing. You know, I think we really ought to all mind our own houses first. And I think that there are rigor questions everywhere. There are rigor questions, for instance, in how we do implementation assessment. There are rigor questions in how we do needs assessment. There are rigor questions in terms of how we do construct validity. And so I think it's important for us to be concerned about rigor, but not to use it as a bludgeon. And I know I do that verbally sometimes, and I know that some of the people who do the RCT stuff do, and it really does, I think, distort the debate in such a way that we're losing sight of the fact that there are rigor questions about, for instance, when and under what criteria. What are the rigorous criteria by which we should decide to do an RCT or to do a case study, right? And I think that there's where I'd like to see the debate go in the future, and not let ourselves get subsumed by the rhetoric here. But I have to confess, I typically tend to fall for that, and I apologize.
Yeah, I guess my point is that we really need to pay attention to the way in which language is used in these kind of debates.
Yep.
And not let the zealous proponents of particular methodologies take all the good words.
Thank you. And
these guys have had many more good words.
I'd like to take back rigour and scientific. Thank you very much.
There you go.
We've got time for at least one more question before some housekeeping announcements, but please go ahead.
All right, this question is primarily just to Andrew, but you seem to be saying the evaluation is about measuring the overall impact of a program on participants, and by corollary, we should fund those programs with the biggest effect sizes. What does this kind of methodology tell us about the important factors for policy when rolling out such a program? And secondly, is the average effect that you might get in such a RCT for program participants, which with a lot of variable effects for different people may well be zero, is that useful to matching the right solutions to the right context? Or do we see the average solution as the best one for everyone?
So I think they're great questions, and I'll do my best to answer them, though I'll probably fall short. In general, I'm a believer in Rossi's law, the notion that the expected effect, measured effect of any social program is zero. That doesn't mean I'm not idealistic and passionate about trying to close the Indigenous gaps, about trying to reduce the extent of inequality in Australia, get better schools and early childhood. It's just that I expect that most programs that we put in place will not have a large and positive measured effect. And so we ought to be a little bit more rigorous in how we step through it. And I think it's important also to be clear that to a first approximation, we don't actually do any randomised trials in Australia. So when we're talking about randomised trials, this is not about sort of cutting down some large oaks in the forest. This is about casually stepping over and squelching into the ground a couple of little green shoots which are just trying to make their way up. You don't have to believe that everything should be randomised, I certainly don't, but I think we're well below the optimal level of randomised evaluations in Australia. Maybe 1 in 1,000 evaluations is randomised. My guess is we could get better social policies out of that.
Could I just comment on that? Because we're all tragic, so I went onto the internet and looked for RCTs in Australia last night. And I think there are more than you might expect from your Google search. No, that I found a whole lot. They're sort of lurking. It's because evaluation is sort of done everywhere. It's not always labelled that way. There's a lot in parenting, a lot around in health promotion. There are RCTs going on. So, I mean, I still don't think there's heaps of them. To represent them as little twigs in the forest, they're very expensive, and I think we need to look at the opportunity cost there. If we're counting them by the number of evaluations, so you're doing some bit of client feedback that in one program, if you count that as one evaluation, if that's all you do, and over here we have one RCT, it could actually suck up 90% of the funding available. And the other observation I would make is from some of the experience in the US, where there's been extreme enthusiasm for this really over a long time. When I was in the US in the 90s, there was this belief that evaluation did mean RCTs, and there were real problems of little projects feeling compelled to do RCTs because they were the rigorous ones and they had all sorts of technical problems like low statistical power. So I think it's a really good argument to talk about what's appropriate, and I'm absolutely there. I'm certainly not saying, look, RCTs are never appropriate. I think they've got to be in the repertoire, but we need to be very thoughtful about what the consequences are of advocating so strongly for them.
Well, thanks very much, guys. It's been an excellent discussion. Indeed, I was just going to ask you to thank all our panellists as we segue into a little bit of a housekeeping.
Ladies and gentlemen, I've just got a brief announcement about the buses for the dinner tonight. So if you're planning to catch the bus, it's probably wise to just wait a second. You've got in your program, you should have in the kit, bus timetable. There have been some slight changes to those. The changes are on the message board, but I'll just run through them fairly quickly for you. Bus 1 will now go past the Hotel Realm, departing there at 6:45 before going on to the Hyatt Hotel. Bus 2 will stop at Ridges Lakeside at approximately 6:40. It will not stop at the front. It will be on the side street, which is Edinburgh Avenue. For those who are staying at the Ridges, it's the one that runs off towards the National Convention Centre. It's not the one at the back. It's the one that comes off London Circuit and goes off towards the National museum. Sorry. So it's the side of the Ridges Hotel. And a plea, if you're planning on catching one of the buses, try and get there at least 5 minutes early. I had the unfortunate experience last week with a different company, I have to say, of somebody getting there to see the bus disappearing into the distance. So I really strongly support that notion that you try and get there 5 minutes early. And I look forward to seeing you all at dinner. Cheers.